This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
I know there's a lot of people here who have something to say. It can be questions, responses, comments, provocative things, whatever, because we cut you off in order to have our pit stop. So we might go back to those people. There really is no design here. Everyone can say stuff, have a conversation or whatever flows, and responses to the day or responses to the exhibition or responses to some of the issues that have been spoken of. I know it's very difficult to unpack the complexity of the things that have been said today, but that's your intellectual challenge for the day.
Oh, hi. Mari Geisler, just finishing up a PhD on Arnhem Land bark painting. And we have here one of the great heroes, Bernice Murphy, sitting here. She was one of the most amazing people in the history of getting Aboriginal art accepted as contemporary by showing it, first of all, with mainstream Western art. But apart from that, my question is, because I'm on the artist's historical area, is I'd love to know what discourses or art historical discourses the Songlines exhibition can be spoken in. What to the everyone on the panel, or the art historians and those within the cultural area, when we talk about the Songlines paintings and the Songlines art, how can we talk about them in the discourses of art history? Because often Aboriginal art always gets discussed, or often gets discussed in just anthropological texts. It's always struggling, or often struggling, to be seen as contemporary or actually engaging with contemporary issues. So, just going back, I'd like to see if that question's understood, and if people would like to comment from their perspectives on what that Songlines exhibition and all the work that Margot's done on so many levels, what discourses can we actually discuss it in? Because this is going on the public record.
Mm. Ian, you're the guru of all... I guess if I was just rephrasing, so would it be correct to say, how would you talk about this exhibition? In what terms? What language? And how does it plug into or extend contemporary ways of speaking about this as an exhibition contemporary in art history terms, if you must?
Well, I'd say a couple of things about... I'm an art historian, by the way, so I have to defend my patch. But I'd say a couple of things. I think too much is made of the division between anthropology and archaeology and art history, and that they each come out of the same discourse. And once upon a time when you did art history, you didn't start in 100 years ago like you do now. You started way back with the Greeks and the Egyptians and the sort of archetypal stories that this is just one example of. So it is, I think, very easy to especially if you know your history as an art historian, it's actually not very difficult to talk about not only the art, but also the stories and the narratives that run through it within the context of art history. Because this is probably a gross generalisation. I just realised this was about to come out of my mouth, but I'll continue. Most art is about archetypes. So the sort of story that's running through here, you know, someone mentioned the Me Too thing. It runs through pretty well all art, whether it's the Greeks, Italian Renaissance, the Baroque or Picasso in the 20th century right up until now. It's almost like the same stories being told again and again, but, you know, within the contemporary context. So I don't think that it's a very difficult thing to do at all. And, of course, the art itself, or those paintings, you know, we've been talking a lot about technology, but the acrylic painting on a rectangular canvas is also quite a recent technology. that has come into the Indigenous art tradition. And it's a technology that was, brought here by the Western art tradition, but it was obviously not a technology that was all that alien to painting fairly rectangular designs on a chest or things like this. And we've seen how technologies I know nothing about have been able to quite easily work with, you know, very ancient, as Lynette's, you know, great talk talked about. So I don't really see it as a difficulty at all. I see it as a very interesting space to work in.
Well, now that you mentioned Lynette, why don't we...
Thanks, Ian.
Thank you.
I don't know if it answers your question about the discourse of art history, but once you start talking about cave paintings and immersion, there is a repetition worldwide about the way those sites were used. And if you listen to the last panel, about four times the word transmission was used. It's not a communication, it's a transmission. It's something that's meant to go into your body. And the artists, as we would have called, we may not have called them artists, the people who were working in the caves. They might have been called shamans, or they might have been called magicians, or magic people. They're working to create a transmission which is meant to go into your bones, into your bodies, and it's not just about a thing that we work. We can't just use the word art work about some of these things. And the person who spoke before was alluding to that, saying the things that are talked about in the day and the things that are transmitted at night are of a different thing. This chanting, singing is part of it. The kind of singing with a repeated echo. Imagine hearing that in a cave. So it's swirling around you in a trance-like form and it's echoing. It's a repeated phrase and then it echoes in a cave. And what that does, if you're attuned to it, especially if you've been prepared for it, is it takes you into a different state. That slightly altered state, or very altered state, is where the other layers of travelling through time, travelling through stars, could be communicated to you. So I think we have to find different language for some of these things. We can't just orient it within the history of art. We have to place it within the history of our humanity and the way art has been used.
Hello. Look, I'll just say something very quickly in relation to that last question, because I would have a very similar position to Ian, and I'm an anthropologist. So I think that this particular exhibition is one that, in a sense, transcends simplistic kind of categories. And I think one can also say, in relation to what Lisa had said, that one of the things that you can say about this exhibition is that it is contemporary, but it's a contemporary that is actually deeply connected to history as well as oriented towards action in the present. So I think that one of the reasons this exhibition has been so successful is that it is both anthropological, historical, art historical, and that it is using innovative technology, and that it's multidimensional, and that it has extraordinary engagement with the cultures of production and with the artists who produced it. My actual question was going to be at the end of the last session, picking up on what the answer to, I think, Lisa Stefanos' question about resources. Because although I actually do think it's very important that cultural institutions do get resources from endowments and from billionaires, whatever their nationalities, I think that exhibitions like this are extraordinarily important and are funded from multiple sources, including the Australian Research Council as well as the National Museum. That it's unfortunate that many Indigenous communities, in particular in remote areas, but actually generally, are dependent upon project funding. And project funding is something that requires enormous efforts and often coincidence of chance. Someone is inspired either with a lot of money to endow something for a particular thing or there's a long-term project that it fits in with, or there's a gap in a program, all sorts of different things. But it's very contingent source of funding. And I do think that it's very, very important that governments should put resources into Indigenous cultural production. I think you mentioned education as one of those kind of areas where it's absolutely vital to have Indigenous cultural in Indigenous communities, but also more generally as an integral part of our educational system. And I also think that there needs to be much more consistent funding of art and community art centres, community cultural institutions, holding institutions. We've got a framework in Australia that's set up to enable that with the kind of links that I suppose Matt and others have been talking about between major institutions and local communities. We need the resources to be able to follow those kind of links and build on them. So, I mean, my question in a way is to all of you, whether you see the solving of those particular problems as a priority, and it needs vast resources in order to do that.
Howard Morphy for Arts Minister, I think. Seriously, I mean, if only there was that level of insight into the long-term investment that's required. I've already stated our case, which is that we need to go out, with our hats to collect money to do anything beyond opening the doors and keeping the lights on. So I haven't really got anything to add.
Anyone else? There's a number of points made there.
How much would it cost for... John, how much would it cost to actually, spread the one song cycle to encompass the 11 or so that you have deep recordings?
Well, actual cost is $5,000 a minute. And we got a big request of $1 million, of which the university gave us matching funds, and that's enabled us to work in Broome, Ngiyampaa up in northern New South Wales, Kaurna, three languages in Victoria, two in the Gulf, and we're nearly at the end of the money. Yeah, and now we're trying to find more. And I think you touch on something that's really important for all of us, is what do we call art? I said before in my talk that there is no visual art in the Gulf. It's very recent where I work. The actual art form in that community was song poetry. And trying to get people to understand that Indigenous people were poets and are still composing is like, really? Because you can't hang it on a gallery wall. But it goes a step further, and I think Howard will pick up on this. Our university at Monash has just made Indigenous knowledges a key component of what they think all graduates should have some understanding of. Now, you think about just that word, Indigenous knowledges. You know, and my boss wasn't even told it was going to happen. It was just announced. And, the catch-up that's required to even educate those that sit above us as to what they're actually opened their mouth to is actually quite extraordinary.
It's a good point because that's what I propose to do here. Obviously, things grow out of things, so it's an organic process. So no one's made a pronouncement like that here. However, it's so obvious the next place to go with this, given that it encompasses all of the disciplines we've been speaking about, and because we're now not looking at divides between archaeology and anthropology or art, or it clearly... This demonstrates it here today. So a knowledge centre which is the Indigenous way of being, thinking, and learning and teaching, is just, you know, a no-brainer. It's one thing for a university to say, to announce it. Obviously, it's the in thing and it's going to get them funding or kudos or something. Clearly, it's just a bit of a mouthpiece because they haven't even talked to the Indigenous Studies Centre or the bosses or the people who've been doing the Indigenous knowledge. So clearly, there's another little backstory there. But I think in this case, this is a natural progression for us to go into, and people like, you know, Scott and all these people here in various ways could all have some role and part in it. I don't know what it looks like. I just know it's absolutely what has to happen. And it may be called the Songlines Indigenous Centre or Songlines may be just one project of many under Indigenous Knowledge Centre. All that's not sorted out, but it's obviously there's nowhere else to go. And I would suggest that the museum like this is probably moving in that place to that place anyway across the board. Now, this museum, like many, well, this museum at least, I can't speak for the others, has had three themes, you know, Australia, society and history, people and the environment, Pate, Ash and Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander peoples. That's it. Now, that is so, I mean, it's so dinosaurial now. Right, that you can't, that the Indigenous is separate from Australian society and people. And I know that it was important to make political differences and have our own place and all that, but I think now the knowledge centres, which may exist, may be many across the museum that rolls in all those sorts of things, are so, I guess what I'm saying in a way is that the white institutions will learn about what learning is really about, what knowledge is really about, and how you really hold it and transmit it. I mean, it's got a very good track record. So thanks for that, John.
Can I just make a quick...
Yes, oh, anyway, yes, please do.
Okay, just press a button, got it. I mean, I've... Something about how long I spent in the bush thing.
Yeah.
I've lost the plot of what I was going to say now. Oh, in terms of the institute, I have a slight saying, which is not a very good saying, but I'm kind of aware Aboriginal people have experienced colonisation of their land, and I'm concerned that they also experience colonisation of their mind, and the institutionalisation of knowledge kind of slightly concerns me. So my in terms of the, you know, the art history and the money for exhibitions and things, that's a real issue. But there's for me, someone spends a lot of time in the bush, there's a real need for money to get people in the bush. And so in going back to $5,000 a minute, I can go out in the bush and take young men out who learn the songs in ceremony, as I say, but they don't know where the places are in the country. So they've got a theoretical knowledge of their religious lore at the moment. They don't know where it is. Now, we can go out in the bush for about $8,000 a day is the sort of running cost.
That's all right if all the people are still alive.
Well, sorry?
I said that's all right if all the people are still alive.
That's for sure, and they are.
That's the other impact of colonisation.
Of course. No, it's a fraught space, but they are, and that's a... Yeah, that's another side of the dynamic. So where people know country and can actually maintain the songs in country and do effectively what you said, sit around the campfire and learn them.
I'll just say, I think Howard touched on it. These knowledge centres, if they do have a base in an institution like this, which, as I said, is a natural outgrowth. It's done the yards to get to that place. It hasn't just said, what a great idea, let's do it. But it has to be connected to all of the regions, you know, remote and regional and so on anyway, so that it's a bit like that slide I show you where you come into this office and you go into that office and you swap your sort of mobile offices. It can't be based in a physical sense only here. It has to be mobile and has to have all those relationships and connections with all the communities. In fact, in the way the Songlines Project did progress,
exactly.
You know, like that it has to go that sort of way. So it's not colonising the Indigenous knowledge.
Like your image of the long caravanserai going out to Mardu country. It's part of the package.
Yeah. Sorry. Who hasn't spoken first? Hang on. Let me just get someone who hasn't spoken. Did you...
Not
Oh, you have it? Okay. There's a girl up there, and there's a boy down here. There's a girl up there.
I can go. Hello, everybody, and thank you for a fabulous day. I'm absolutely exhausted and brain dead. My name's Chris, and unlike just about everybody else in this room, I'm not doing a PhD, and I don't have one. I'm actually...
Stay clean.
I'm actually... I work at the Chalk Face, what I call the Chalk Face. I'm a teacher. I work with Aboriginal children and in Sydney. And it's an amazing job and I love it. However, that's nothing to do with what I want to ask. I want to ask Matt, you talked about the process of repatriation and I want to just ask you about that as a means of future-proofing. I've seen some of the objects in the Maclay and I wonder, what is the process? How do you choose? Do you choose what goes back? Do people come to you and say, we want that back? How does it work? And do you think it's going to have... I think you alluded to that before, that it, there is going to be an ongoing thing and therefore, I assume that's what you're saying, that there will be some sort of future-proofing. Do you get me?
Yeah. No, it's a great question. I mean, when you do repatriations of ancestral remains, old peoples as communities calls them, you realise very quickly that just the diversity of mortuary experiences around this country. I mean, every community that you repatriate something to is different to the one that you've just done or the one that you will next do as well. There's just so much... work that needs to be done, and I've definitely seen it bring a sense of closure to communities. Just, you know, museums have this, you know, people have this image of museums as these, you know, dark, scientific, dusty sort of things, but, you know, repatriation is one of those things that Australian museums, for example, can really hold their heads high amongst their international contemporaries. There's not many repatriation programs as extensive as the Australian one. You can look to NAGPRA in America, other sort of things like that. But in my very limited experience, you know, repatriation, it also needs a national conversation attached to it because, you know, when ATSIC existed, there used to be these great frameworks where the Aboriginal Medical Service would transport remains and all the logistics were using Aboriginal organisations and they went quite smoothly. You might have seen the car was pulled out of the Melbourne Museum to repatriate Mungo Man home recently because that was the old Aboriginal Medical Service. But where, you know, there's also this thing called unprovenanced, which is the bane of anyone who works in a museum, and there's a lot of unprovenanced remains and there's a lot of undocumented and there's often a lot of mislabeled things, which can be really devastating for modern communities to be sort of tricked again like that, that, you know, here's something sacred that's coming back, and it's not. It was something that was faked in the 50s and looked a bit... so, you know, it's a very, very fraught process. Each repatriation, you know, is an object in itself. There's no sort of simple way to go through it, which I think is why governments especially are a bit hands-off. But, you know, we should... With even documenting the process of what's happened in the last 25 years is really sadly lacking. So, yeah, I don't even know where to start in terms of offering a future-proofing of it.
But you were saying that when you did repatriate certain objects, that it was obvious that there were people... Sorry. It was obvious that it had an effect on the people for whom... who received the object or whatever it was. And that you felt that a relationship was set up for the future. And that's what I'm talking about, perhaps, with you know, within those kinds of, you know, networks or whatever, that perhaps there's a hope for future-proofing.
Actually, there is, because when something is reburied, it's geotagged in the National Parks databases and development can't happen there in the future. So there is great outcomes like that.
Technology.
Hi, my name's Janet. I just wanted to say thanks so much for everything you've brought to light this afternoon. It's been so inspiring to hear you all speak and to just to realise what an exciting time this is, that these incredible technologies are coming to light at the same time that communities are really feeling the urgency to tell these stories and to ensure these stories. So I just want to say thank you for that. My question is, as far as the Songlines exhibition, how is that feeding... Is there plans to take this exhibition back onto country or back to those communities? Because I imagine a lot of the, like, the young people haven't been to visit Canberra and see the full extent of this, and sort of how do they continue to benefit from all this amazing research and...
Yeah, well, clearly it's developed a life of its own. It's got away from me a bit. You know, actually, it's an interesting question. There's lots of things in the pipeline. Clearly, it's come from country to come here in order to bring everyone else on board who, once on board, can help it get back to country and engage young people. And there's the ARC project that went before, where so all the archivists, I don't know whether you were here earlier, the Outer Iritija archive in Alice Springs, which is, you know, platforms, digital platforms and so on. So there's a lot of interactivity there. So everything that led into this ends up there and backstopped at other places, which comes through with Dinah Jones and Howard Morphy in the ANU part of it. But the... you know, there's all sorts of... It's an open field. It's got a life of its own. It will keep moving. It'll do a national tour. It'll do an international tour. It'll go in a full scale, a smaller scale. The dome's able to travel without anything else. It's a collapsible dome. Could end up in Araluen. Could end up in Magnet. It could end up out in the community. Who knows? It's unlimited possibilities, and it's that that's sort of flowing back in now. And there'd be... I can assure you that the museum will be as absolutely responsive as it is physically capable of being to any interest or requests or anything to re-engage, particularly with younger people, because that's how that's what the whole thing is about in the baseline. But anyway, that's what's in plan now, and it could be some, all, part of, and the digital programs that will also assist. I know there's already a lot of interest with young people and communities that are now looking at this exhibition, and there's a, as you know, interactive website, and there's even more going on in that space.
Thank you. My name is Bernice Murphy. I just wanted to give you a little reflection that arcs over a number of key issues that have been raised here, from Howard's question about getting greater government support through to so many important experiences that have been opened up for us in this, I must say, one of the most wonderful symposia on these issues that have been tracked through for a very long time. My reflection first... Some years ago, my partner and I were at a real Labour party in Sydney at the home of Evan Williams. And we had the chance to talk with Gough Whitlam for a little while. And my partner had been the first director of the Visual Arts Board and very close to that period of Gough's agency implementing that marvellous vision of his. But we had the chance to ask him, how did he hit the ground running, so to speak, with so much agency, commitment, and vision that so much was done that it created a kind of velocity of energy that irradiated the whole country, had an impact in the world, and so on. Just briefly, and I'm going to link this back to Jen's talk, you see, Gough was so well-educated, I will say, not just in the Western sense, but Greek and Roman culture takes us right back to archetypes, mythology, stories. The power of irradiating stories was something very much in Gough's whole culture. And before he became Prime Minister, when he was in opposition, he and Margaret Whitlam used to take all the trips that a lot of the other politicians on the government side didn't want to take, to all kinds of boring places like Athens and Egypt and other sites where people were very happy to let them go and represent Australia in some meeting. And Gough was, and Margaret, always going straight to the archaeological sites, the museums, the cultural sites. Slight difference with Whitlam, with Keating. I won't go on too long because I'm coming back to the exhibition. I don't want to diminish or take away from poor Keating's great impact, the Redfern speech, the work he did on native title. But Keating did not have anything like that cultural vision that Gough Whitlam had, and hence the mistakes of creating the Keatings, these over, really exaggerated scholarships of that time, and a lot of things fell away. But so I want to come back and link this, and again back to Howard's questions and others, the power of these exhibitions. And I believe that it finally comes down to not splitting hairs between anthropology and archaeology or art spaces or where things occur. The most important thing is the demonstrative power of these projects, and Songlines is one of the greatest ever, because you create a velocity of energy in the public space, and through that, that is your reference point to go to politicians, not going with some well-written submission or whatever detail. They don't understand the detail. It's the power of this kind of experience that is the greatest artery to opening up the work that needs to be done, and the kind of resources you want would be a rounding off error in Defence Department budgets. You know, so you don't go with a sort of well-argued case and achieve greater success. You go with the vision, and this is going to cost millions, maybe. And often you will get it if you can communicate the imaginative power of the cause, the idea, and its impact to change this country. So I just wanted to draw those few remarks together and hope they strike some resonance. Thank you.
Thank you, Bernice. Actually, that's exactly our thinking. You know, it's a cumulative thing. Clearly from the genesis of the exhibition, the research project, the energy, you have to keep that energy going. And I think those who would have done the tour yesterday, the thing that, you know, the mob wanted to have their material archived for future generations. But then, as I say, well then why do you need an exhibition? You don't need that to put the knowledge into an archive, you know. And the answer is, apart from my flippant one, was everyone wants a party. Apart from that one, it was really, I think, strategic. The elders were being, the custodians were being very strategic. They know that if you want to save the song lines, you know, depositing this knowledge for the younger is only one way to go. You've got to capture the entire nation. You've got to get the political will. You've got to get everyone so engrossed and involved and sensorially attached that they do exactly what you're saying. They've got to absolutely enter them the way everyone's spoken about today. It's got to go beyond the rational and beyond the cerebral. And I think all the stuff you would have heard so this morning, this afternoon, it's all about that. And when you think of this whole knowledge system that we're talking about, oh, it's up there. People like Amanda comes out with tears out of her. She doesn't know why. I said, why are you crying? Oh, I don't know, it's so visceral, she says. And then you go to, you know, and all these other people, like, and I used to have a tear brigade, you know, at the cloakroom, say, tell me how many people you see coming out crying today. Because that's the mark of success, and, you know, my role in it at least is, that's my final benchmark, is the exhibition must sing, and then you've got to get people crying. And then you know you got it, you know, you've got them in here. And you're so right, and I totally approve. I totally agree. Anyway, off my platform.
I would like to, because the trouble is, and Howard mentioned this, is that we have corridors of funding, and this is not this is not just around art. So actually the funding needs to come beyond art, because actually where it should come from is where what are we talking about in terms of health? What are we talking about legalities? What are we talking about in terms of sustainable land management in this country? What are we talking about in terms of history? And all of those branches which have their own funding need to contribute. Not just this wonderful kind of framing, but under a banner of art, where the arts are not fully funded. It's not just about art funding, then.
No, definitely not. This is the one that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I better not keep talking. There's a question. I'm just looking for people who may not have had an opportunity to speak yet.
I'll be quick. So, Sue Berry, I said one thing before too. I had the privilege of being mother of Aboriginal children, yet I was born outside of Australia. I've got a grad dip going to become a teacher, and I'd gladly apprentice myself to any of these people here, because I think it all comes together. And so I just wanted to say, in terms of transmission, from what I've learned from the people that have taught me, is I wanted to correct something up there. You had the guy for the Australian saying, oh, this was about five people, and he listed Arnungu as one of these people. Well, just so nobody takes away the wrong message, Arnungu, as my partner and family says, means people.
Yeah.
It means human being. And that's about why the people brought to us Arnungu here, everything they've brought and everything within in Central and South Australia, and then the other groups, which I don't know so much about because I'm not related to them. But when you learn to say those words and you have a warm feeling towards them, then you automatically have to be included in that big family, because there's no such thing as stranger in the people of this land. So you have to be given a kinship so people can communicate with you. So then you become Arnungu, you become a person in this language. And I just think that's how important all this is, why we're all here today.
Thank you.
Hello, thank you. John Lamb is my name. Yes, firstly, thank you for a truly inspirational day. And I suppose what to me it was about, and the learning for me was that depth of Aboriginal culture and knowledge, its pervasiveness, and all those storylines, and what we should value in that. And it's all been about the value of that Aboriginal culture in everything we do. My particular interest, and what I'd like to ask about, though, is the multicultural background and how we fit it in. The Aboriginal story in Australia, the first Australian, has got the connection through Southeast Asia, the Macassans. It's got the Chinese from the early gold rush times, it's got the Japanese from the pearl and cane cutting, it's got this multicultural background that makes us Australian today. Exactly how do we fit it in and value and protect those original stories at the same time?
Really important question. Every first year lecture I do, I talk about Macassans and Afghans. And even today, maybe one student puts their hands up and says, I know about Macassan contact. The people that get really excited about it in my lectures are the Southeast Asian students, because they find a connection to Australia that they understand. And the white Australian kids or the Australian-born kids are going, we didn't know this. So there's something here about a failure in education. There's something here about primary school education and high school education that isn't teaching exactly what you're talking about how Indigenous Australians actually were the first international ambassadors for Australia, how the first export industry wasn't merino sheep. No, seriously. And that there were people where I work and going further north who could speak these languages and who travelled there and had children with people. And the kinship that we still know speaks to this. So I think it is actually a really, really seminal question, not so much for Indigenous Australians, but for white Australians to understand, because I think part of the fear we're still living with is the white Australia policy was very powerful. And it still sits under all this understanding of our relationships with Southeast Asia, Afghanistan, you know, the Afghani Cameliers, which you didn't mention, but are in that, which, interestingly, are also our first contacts with Islam, going back 600 years or more. It's only a statement, but I think it's a really important one.
I think we've probably got time for, it depends on how long it goes on. I think it's a really good thing that we should hang and pursue at another time. There's one, and perhaps Anne McGrath, and that might be it, I think, unless they're exceptionally brief.
And I take it all back. There is singing after all, Margot.
I just had it put on for your benefit.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll be sung out of here at the end. Soon, very soon.
Uta Eichelkamp, anthropologist, working on the APY lands and in Germany, hopefully, very soon, where actually arts funding and economy, public health is all coming together to restore an entirely destroyed landscape, coal mining region, into a new, better, greener, bluer economy and environment, while the working class lives of the people there are being shown in museums. So culture and nature are being restored to a certain way, but they're looking towards the arts to make that happen and try and imagine a future that has never existed. It doesn't come out of the past, but has to be reimagined altogether. But I wanted to just critically ask, perhaps, do we need to be cautious? Is there are limits to immersive technologies or dangers that we should become aware of now going into the future, you know, to shift country into the museum? And I mean, I'm reading John Dewey at the moment, right? Artics as experience. He would just be applauding you, Margot, I'm sure, you know. But how does it really reverberate back into everyday lives? A bit connected to your question, where does it leave us, all of us, in our everyday lives, in terms of aesthetic experience?
There's two ways to go here now. Either somebody just do a little response to that, or we just leave that as a really interesting comment, and then it gives us time to have another really interesting comment. Is that okay? You're in trouble now, Anne. It better be interesting. Can be a question, but I just know we actually have literally 3 minutes.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the opportunity. I've got 3 minutes? Okay.
Oh, no.
I'm Anne McGrath from the Australian National University, and I'm a historian. And, I'd just like to congratulate everybody involved today. It was really inspiring. And Margot and her co-curators from many different parts of Australia, the traditional owners of the song lines. And I think that idea of co-curating is really important. And as a historian, I'm thrilled by this exhibition. I think it's a game changer because I think that Australians and perhaps the international people had really come to appreciate Indigenous visual art, but as a commodity and as an aesthetic exhilarating experience. And so I think that this exhibition takes it beyond that. It's about deep stories and human stories of connection. And sure, kids in Australia don't learn about it at all when they study history, but it is a way to connect with the deep human past that took place on this continent. And the generosity of people sharing that through performance and through many different modes of what I call historical practice. And I guess the issue is that, yes, young people do get taught other song lines, Captain Cook and Matthew Flinders and all these navigation lines that crisscrossed the oceans and landed up here. And they became the de facto dreaming stories of the Australian nation. So I think, thank God, we're finally connecting with very deep stories. And I might say that as soon as Philip arrived, they were connecting with Greek legends and ancient legends, and they were ignoring the Indigenous legends, more or less. So hopefully this is a moment, and it's wonderful that some school teachers are here, and hope that the young generation can learn through this kind of exhibition.
Do you want to say something, Paola?
Lisa,
yeah.
And I.
Oh, Lisa and I.
If you haven't noticed, we're the only people that have
one.
Is it?
Oh, okay.
Let the panel have the last say.
If the panel and audience haven't noticed yet, Lisa and I are the only people that haven't spoken yet. So apart from Margot is the only other Aboriginal women that are here. So just a little reminder about listening. And that the brother down the front has been waiting for a really long time to speak. Yeah. He had a question before, so we'd like to find that.
And just noting he's the only person who's actually been silenced, which I'm, I'd like to hear from you.
Do you have a last word?
Sorry, there was just the question about funding, what level of funding and indoctrination. I think it's worth reading the Melbourne Declaration and the 15 contributors to the Melbourne Declaration. There was an Indigenous person that had been gone through a mission and contributed a mission voice, and that helped form our educational framework within Australia. And if you consider the funding, if you go to the funding estimates for schools, per 1,000 students in a school is about $5 million. If you consider here in the ACT, we have about 2,600 identified Indigenous students, then that parity level would be $10 million plus funding. If you consider the number of Indigenous schools that are Indigenous-owned, Indigenous-operated, because that Declaration of Melbourne wasn't a bilateral agreement to create the Indigenous framework as part of the curriculum or indoctrination systems, then it would give you an idea of how many schools we should have and funded to what level as part of that symbiotic relationship, the partnership. And that's just for parity. That's not looking towards, the past. I think there's a lot to say about education and Indigenous engagement.
You're the lady from New York. I was just thinking about that. I was thinking, wouldn't it be nice to find out how you... What brought you here, what it's done for you, and we'll have to finish on that note, otherwise we'll get locked in.
I'll be very short, and again, I'm not a PhD student, I'm here just, my name is Grace, I'm here as a person in the world who heard the call of Songlines and when it came across my Facebook feed and said I'm coming. I thought I was coming to a funeral. I told people I was coming to witness the end of storylines, songlines, this culture that was dying, these cultures, and how do you not go and bear witness to that? My tears were shed all before I came. Since I've been here, all the time I would cry. This is a celebration. This is a renaissance, a coming back to life. I honor all of the work and integrity and beauty and love that's gone into this, that word love someone shared before. I'm taking home a lot of love. I'm witnessing a lot of love, creativity and intelligence, and plan to share a lot of the good news and with a lot of respect for the challenges, and certainly you can appreciate the challenges that we are facing in other ways in my country right now. But I want to say that and say thank you, and really enheartened by the VR work and the other Indigenous peoples that you're giving a voice to and a chance for us to connect with our deep humanity. So that's what I have to say. Thank you.
Well, New York's in our sights. You might be able to help. Who do you know other than Trump? I'll talk to you if you know that. No. Look, thank you so much. And I think, we don't want to end. And lots of people have things to say, I know. And I'm sure there's... I wondered whether they have... Anyway... The time's up. So we have to go, and I have to thank each and every one of you for making it such a wonderful day, and all of you people who were so interactive and warm. As I said, the love, all loved up. I hope everyone goes home feeling all loved up. And there's only 3 days, 4 days, 5 days left of this iteration of Songlines. And you can all... do what you have to do to activate for its continuance in your own ways. And I do hope the conversation continues in many different ways. So thank you so much, everybody, for being here all day. And would you mind giving this mob a...
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.